And welcome to this month's episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, where we discuss the way that popular culture covers politics. My name's Emma Burnell, and I'm a political journalist. And I'm joined, as always, by Professor Stephen Fielding from the University of Nottingham. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Emma.
And very confusingly, for all considered, we have another Steve with us today. Really, really delighted to be joined by Steve Waters, who is a playwright and author of the thing we're going to talk about largely today, which is Limehouse. Hello, Steve.
Oh, hi there. Hi, yes, and sorry I'm called Steve.
Yeah, can't be helped. blame the parents, that's what I say. So I thought it would be useful. Limehouse is about a breakaway grouping from the Labour Party. So I thought it might be useful for you, Steve F, as our resident historian, to talk us through the circumstances that the play depicts. So do you want to kind of give us the background?
Yes, and let me also use this as an opportunity to plug my very good Radio 4 documentary called "When How to Break Up the Party," which actually looks at all the various times in which political parties have broken up, all the way back to the Corn Laws in 1846. And of course, we did deal with the SDP split, and Steve's play is basically about the day in which the Gang of Four, that's the four sort of leading members of the Labour Party from the 60s and the 70s, came out and declared that they were going to create a new party. They were going to leave the Labour Party and create the SDP. And it all takes place on the 25th of January 1981, in the kitchen, mostly, of Dr. David Owen, one of the so-called Gang of Four. And the reason why, the thing that really pushes them over the edge is that the day before, at a special conference, the Labour Party had decided to have an electoral college to vote for the Labour leader. Up till that point, only MPs could decide who was the leader. And so far as the Gang of Four were concerned, and many others actually, this kind of meant that the Labour left around Tony Benn had basically taken control of the party, because it gave the unions, I think, being the historian, I think, 40% of the electoral college, MPs 30, and constituencies 30%. So that was where the left was based, in the unions, or at least a significant number of them, and the constituency party. So everyone believed Tony Benn and Bennism was in the Labour Party for the foreseeable future, if not forever. So they had this dilemma: what do we do as revisionists, as moderate right wing, depending on how you wish to describe them, which we can maybe talk about. They said, this is not the party for us anymore. The party has changed. And that had been a culmination of events since the 1970s. There'd been an economic crash. The Labour Party under Benn, the trade unions were becoming more militant, activists were becoming more militant. And it was, in actual fact, for at least a time, a very different party, and one that those who'd been in control of the party up to that point just thought, we might as well set up a new party. But that makes it very simple, that decision. And actually, Steve's play is about those four people thinking about discussing what to do. So that's my little bit of history. I don't know if Steve would think I might think I've missed something out.
I think that was magnificent, actually. And I wish I'd had your program when I was working on the play, actually. and there's a, you know, I have to say, you know, today, I wrote this play 2 years ago, no, 3 years ago now, actually. So forgive me if I'm a little rusty on some of the details, because obviously one nail knocks out another, and, you know, there's been other projects since then. So I actually reread it on Friday and thought, oh, you know, this play's pretty good. But there's different things I might need to reacquaint myself before I actually talk about it in front of other people. But that was a terrific summary. Thank you.
I mean, the thing we should probably tell our listener is that Emma and I did not see the stage version, which was...
I tried to get tickets and I couldn't.
Not living in London, I couldn't even consider that. So we read it, which is, of course, a very different kind of experience. But when it was staged in the spring of 2017, you had a very interesting cast. And the idea of Roger Allam as Roy Jenkins, that just blows my mind. How that would have been.
Well, he was, of course, utterly magnificent, and you know, this wonderful footage of Roger, as it were, kind of bolding up to become Roy Jenkins in the dressing room, which was actually a massive process for him every day to kind of appear like Roy Jenkins physically. But he heroically undertook that task.
Roger Allam's got very thick, luscious hair, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. People were kind of really bitterly angry that they couldn't see Roger Allam's hair, which they probably paid to go and see for the afternoon or the evening.
And the hair and the voice and the presence all speak much more to me of David Owen. So it's a very interesting casting.
Well, there's a question of age, isn't there? I mean, because actually Roger's... You know,
I'm thinking of the David Owen I knew a few years later.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and also I think one of the things that's fascinating about the Gang of Four is those, the sort of, the decades that separate them, because Roy at that point was in his 60s, you know, Shirley and Bill were in their early 50s, and David was a relatively youthful, as was Debbie, in early 40s. So actually that is a very significant element of the dynamic, I think, between the so-called Gang of Four.
I think the first question, the most direct question after talking about Roger Allam's hair, which of course is
important.
I guess everyone is interested in that. We brought it up. I brought it up. Is why did you write a play about these centrist splitters who betrayed the Labour Party?
Well, you put the question extremely well, Steve. I mean, it's a good question, actually. As I say, I embarked upon it in the summer of 2016. Oh, no, actually, it was spring 2016. And so often, the kind of impulse to write a play comes from quite external things. So I'd actually had a show on at Domar about 18 months before that called Temple, which was all about the sort of Occupy events and how they played out in St. Paul's Cathedral. And so they were keen to work with me again. And I wanted at that point to work with the director, Howard Davis, who sadly did not survive to put on Limehouse, which was a great, great tragedy in some respects. So there was this conversation about writing another piece for the Donmar. And I guess the basic premise was this feeling of the rudderlessness of the left. I mean, when I was writing it, we were in the summer of the Owen Smith kind of leadership challenge, I think, from Corbyn. Corbyn had been in, you know, when I really embarked, he'd been in for about sort of 6 months. Then we had obviously the still searing events of the referendum. So I had a very strong feeling about the confusion and turbulence within what one might call the left, and particularly within the Labour Party. And my own sort of slightly mixed feelings about the Labour Party's heritage and my relationship to that. I'd actually left the Labour Party a few years before I joined the Green Party for a bit. This is a real admission of heresy here, I suppose. And then felt during the 2015 election, what have I done? So that kind of turbulence, I think I was feeling kind of internally as well. So naturally, I look back to another period of turbulence. And you've mentioned there are many others, moments where parties have split apart, or particularly the Labour Party. It seems to be almost a kind of 30-year interval where an event of this nature happens within the Labour Party. And I just remember very vividly, my mum and dad were lifelong Labour supporters, and they went with the SDP in the early 80s. They were classic kind of mainstream working class Labour supporters. And yet there's something about David Owen that really appealed to them. I remember that from the mid 70s, actually. And they really felt infuriated by the Bennett takeover. I felt differently. I mean, I was about 15 at the time, so I wasn't particularly engaged in politics, but I really didn't like the look of the Gang of Four, and continue to feel that way as I started to come to sort of more perhaps mature view of what politics might involve. So looking back at them, I thought, God, no, they're actually really extraordinary for extraordinary individuals. I don't know what I think, even to this day, about the Social Democratic Party or the various outgrowths of it. I know that it obviously kind of split the left vote for a very long period after that particular event in 1981. But I think on that particular day, the Gang of Four interested me very intensely, because I thought this is really a day where they were asking questions about what politics was for. And I think we're all asking that question right now. And we certainly were 2016, 2017, and even more so, I think, today.
Because when it came out, and obviously when you said when you started writing it, it did seem very similar to the British politics. You know, the left, you know, was behind an extreme Labour leader who most people thought was completely hopeless electorally, and the Labour Party was divided, and there was, you know, talk of coups and divisions and whatever. And with a Conservative Party which was very much to the right, you know. So there were lots of parallels. Yeah. But now, would you say that? So it's interesting. You said you probably still write it in the same way. I think. I mean, do you think those parallels are still there with, you know, Jeremy? Because somebody on the left, on the Jeremy Corbyn side of the party, would say, you know, this is a very one-sided. And Jeremy has shown that the parallels aren't really there anymore because he's shown this new path.
Well, that was an interesting. The new music around that was quite interesting at the time because the show ran from March to end of April 2017. And a lot of interest, and you know, I cannot tell you who walked through the doors of that show, from Philip Hammond to, you know, Nick Clegg or whatever, you know, kind of. And I'm not seeking that audience, by the way, but it was quite interesting as a sort of distorting mirror of the moment. But then, of course, came the June election, and to be honest, Limehouse couldn't get arrested for the next 6 months. There was a sense that the absolutely outrageous observation in the last speech of the play that, you know, Labour was a minority practice was seemed to be sort of shot out of the water by what, in retrospect, I think was a sort of slightly hectic moment, an exciting moment where Corbyn seemed to find his voice and the Labour Party suddenly seemed to be on the block again. Do we feel the same way 2 years on? I mean, I feel that feels like a bit of a busted flush. I mean, the Tories could not go any lower, that's for sure. The sense that they are the natural party of rule seems a very difficult thing to accept. But we do seem to be now in this extraordinary logjam, really, or stalemate. And I think the sort of inherent weaknesses of the Corbyn project are more clear now, actually, than they were probably in spring 2017. And I must stress, by the way, that the play was never intended as a barrage and attack on Jeremy Corbyn. It was very much more about trying to understand what a Labour Party that's worthy of the name might even look like. What does socialism still mean? Those kind of questions, which are slightly bigger questions. Actually, I think the circumstances, the framing of contemporary politics makes Limehouse more relevant than ever. And clearly with the independence group, what do they call the independence group? I keep getting confused as to what they're called.
Independent group.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I think for good and bad reasons, they make the play very visible again. One of the things that strikes me is utterly immediately when I think about those guys is they just do not have the stature of the figures that we're talking about at the centre of that particular split in 81. And that, I think, is already, if you like, been borne out by the lack of impact of that breakaway moment. Even though, actually, in some respects, I think some of the Tories that left excited me more as departures than some of the Labour people that left. But so I think maybe we're back in a time where Limehouse does start to look pertinent as opposed to sort of something that represents a low point for Corbyn, which he then managed to sort of turn the corner on. I think there is an enduring truth in the fact that all of our major parties are under enormous strain. They don't really know quite who they stand for. We don't know what we want to do with them. And I guess if you're an MP right now, in whatever party, you must be wondering what actually a party means, and hence the virtue of your documentary, Steve.
I think it's really interesting. There seems to be kind of two flavours running through the play. First of all is the examination of where the Labour Party is seen, certainly by the central characters, to be failing. Others from that time might have said differently, but certainly they didn't succeed electorally for a very long time. But equally, the inherent strengths and weaknesses of the what became the SDP. And there's a couple of things in the writing that I think are really interesting in this moment. So, for example, and both of the quotes I'm about to use are from Bill Owen. Bill
Rogers.
Rogers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that says it all, really, doesn't it? So we'll be breaking the mold of two-party politics, a bid for the radical centre, which is exactly the language that Tucker Romano has used about the Tigray. Mm. And then secondly, when they are finally discussing if they're going to jump, you only leave something if you know where you're going is worthwhile, better, not some self-congratulatory gesture. Mm. And I think that is, and then later on in the speech that follows that, you know, we're going to destroy the party that made us all, and will be hated for that, and rightly so. Yeah. think that, you know, that really does foreshadow certainly the critique that I have of the TIG group, which is that, you know, if I could have Corbynite economics without the nastiness, you know, I'd bite your hand off. But yeah. I don't see that on offer. And equally, the reaction from the Labour Party as a whole, but in particular some the more Corbynite elements of the, you know, the immediate let go out and campaign to have by elections in Streatham, etc. And I think that has been, you know, that's been a way of bloodletting, I think, of saying we hate you, and we have a right to hate you, and here's our democratic mandate for hating you. And there's absolutely no way to force those by-elections. Even the Recall Act, I don't think would be triggered in this case, because they haven't, you know, broken the law, which is why we're going to have one in, probably going to have one in Peterborough. So I'm wondering about some of the language in the play. Is how reflective of it? So there's a bit, again, it's Bill. Bill gets all the best lines. I wonder something like New Labour. Is that real, or is that just you having a little bit of an interesting playwright?
I'm delighted to tell you that that is real. And of course, it was too good a trick to play. I mean, I think you're right that in some respects, the emotional heart of the play is Bill Rogers, actually, who strikes me. I mean, I had the privilege of meeting all the, you know, still living members of the gang, and I found them all very, very interesting. And I mean, another thing that will be interesting to talk about relative to TIG is that sense of that this is a play about a kind of pact of friendship. There's a sort of depth of relationships between the core members of the gang, particularly with someone like Bill Rogers and Roy Jenkins, where there was, you know, a very long standing, almost kind of form of sort of hero worship between Bill and Roy, that goes right back to the early 60s, you know, and they were sort of camped around Gateskill. And indeed, you know, Shirley and Bill goes back to sort of the early days when they were both in the Fabian Society. And so you've got a life lived in politics is what's at stake here, I think. You know, you've got people here who've been ministers, you know, only sort of 18 months previously in some cases, right at the heart of Labour's sort of darkest days, really, in the late 70s. So they've really been tested. They've been through the fire together. I think, again, with TIG, that's just not apparent, is it? That, you know, you've got a very miscellaneous bunch of people leaving a party for very different reasons. Some of them beyond reproach. I mean, Luciana Berger has obviously, you know, been hounded out of the party, in all truth. I think Chooker's got his reasons for leaving are very clear and very strong, although I think what he has to offer other than a kind of a vote for the people is not that clear. But that some of the other people, Mike Gapes or Gavin Shook or whatever, you know, I have no really clear idea from the fact they don't like Jeremy Corbyn while they're leaving the party. So, and also they haven't had that long sort of process of exhausting every avenue. I mean, you know, Bill Rogers and Roy Jenkins were sending up sort of distress flares from 1979 onwards. So we're looking at nearly 2 years worth of preparatory stuff and soundings out and attempts to sort of talk to Michael Foot or, you know, engage with the left within the party. Shirley was still on the National Executive even at this point. So, you know, you feel the pain of having to make this decision. And obviously partly what the action of the play is suddenly David Owen, who in some respects was the latecomer to this particular project, forcing the pace. I have slightly overplayed how that happened. I have to confess that because for dramatic purposes. But there's no doubt that it was his energy that meant that they jumped. And I, you know, again, it just feels that with the TIG group, it feels, you know, there are many very good reasons why those people have left the Labour Party, but they're not the same reasons and they don't convert into a forward politics. So that in a way, Bill's reservations seem to be much more relevant to them than perhaps even the Gang of Four.
Although you do say, I mean, in the play, I don't know which character it is, because these are four very different people, as you make plain, and they've had different routes to the day of the 25th of January and the decision to leave. But one says, basically, the only thing we've got in common is Europe, is our passion for Europe, and how important it is. And the other thing that also comes across, and that clearly does, that thing, that's something that TIG definitely has got, that's one thing that might unite them. But the other thing is, it's just how wearied and demoralised and just hateful they feel about all of the abuse that they're getting from within the Labour Party and how they're treated. And I'm sure you're articulating what they thought rather than making a description, you know, an objective description. But, you know, they refer to the left and the people like Ben and others. It's like a fascist rally. You know, they refer to, you know, extreme communism and all of that. And they're just so hacked off with how they're treated, and they just don't really understand it fully. And actually, I did an interview Chukka, and that was one thing he just said. It's just after a while, you just go, what is it all about? So there might be some parallels. I mean, I wouldn't want to draw any, but you certainly draw out the human. I mean, you know, I guess this is what plays do about politics, I suppose, the humanity of the people who are making these big decisions, yeah, and try to understand their mixed motives, their ambiguities, and, you know, how do they make these big decisions? And it's not as easy as people standing from outside might think. And I thought it was really brilliant. I don't know if they really did help make the, what was it? It was a macaroni cheese.
They definitely didn't make macaroni cheese. I can tell you that bombshell right now.
Why are they using Chateau Lafitte? Because you very, I mean, there's so many lovely little references to how middle class the whole thing is. I thought that was very interestingly done. You know, literally the first line is, we summered in Long Island. No summers anywhere.
But you make them self-aware of that. They're not like arrogantly middle-class people who just don't, they're in a bubble and they don't understand what's going on outside. Because I guess this did happen when David, the Owens, sort of let these striking miners sleep in their house.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's in his autobiography, Time to Declare. I mean, I think in some respects, one of the things I admire about the gang is that in a way they're more honest about the fact that you can be, you know, that leftism isn't necessarily puritanical, that they, I mean, obviously they foreshadow in that respect some of the best and the worst of New Labour in the late 90s. But they're, you know, I think that they themselves carry a kind of biography of the Labour Party in the 20th century that I find very moving. You know, obviously Shirley Williams, so embedded in the party and in what it meant to be on the left in England during the 20th century, through familial roots and just through experience. Roy Jenkins, I mean, my goodness, absolutely at the heart of the Labour Party from birth, practically, through the fate of his father's own tenure as an MP, his connections with that great post-war government of which he was part. So, you know, it's this kind of effortless way from their experiences into the entire history of the Labour Party. And I think that's why I think Roy Jenkins is particularly interesting, because, I mean, all four of them, in a way that I do struggle to see now, are in some respects intellectuals. They articulate a vision of the left, which is soft left. I wouldn't go so far as even to call it centrist, because I think that's in some respects a term which comes a little bit later. And there's a degree to which they do think, pretty much three of the four think of themselves as socialists, and unapologetically so. I think Roy Jenkins is definitely post-socialist by that point in a way that's very interesting. But he then expresses this other history of Labour and the sort of boundary between Labour and the Liberal Party being extremely permeable, and a more liberal version of Labourism than sometimes we associate with the Labour Party. And I found that very exciting, going back to, you know, people within the party who would knock off a book of history in the morning and then, you know, kind of run the European economic community, or, you know, they were really, you know, impressive figures of real scope, who also lived very full lives, and they're still living very full lives in three cases. I mean, they have a huge hinterland, to use the Dennis Healey term, and that's distressingly difficult to see in some of our contemporary politicians of any stripe, actually. So in a way, there was a degree to which I did feel the play was an attempt to celebrate what it might be to be a politician in a time when we're cursing them with every other breath. So, I think, as you say, I mean, the middle-classness is a source of fun in the play, but actually isn't that in some respects where the Labour Party was going away anyway, where British culture was going? I mean, David Owen, with his wonderful house in Limehouse, which he pretty much built himself, or at least kind of gentrified with his bare hands, offered a model, if you like, of a different version of what it might be to be on the left in the late 70s, late 60s. And I think that's what they were reaching for with that party, a party that reached beyond a kind of slightly more tribal sense of social identity in the United Kingdom.
I think that's really interesting. I think that's an interesting moment maybe to read the final speech, which is not by one of the Gang of Four.
No.
But in fact, by Debbie Owen, who was David Owen's wife. And please, apologies to everyone for my dramatic reading, of which I'm not going to use your American accent. We read things through how they play out. What if there'd been no Falklands War and the SDP had stormed the nation in 83? Even then we got a quarter of the vote. What if Shirley had stepped up to the plate and led instead of Roy? What if, what if, what if? The SDP crashed out by the 90s. I was probably their last member. Labour rallied, and 83 saw the election of a young lawyer, Anthony Charles Linton Blair. So what was that day in January about? An ectopic pregnancy? Another middle-class luncheon club between four ill-assorted misfits? Five, I should say. I only know the biggest business these days in Limehouse is high-end estate agents, and that we can't see the sky for banks and condos, and that the gang, if they're alive, are all old and Lib Dems or politically homeless, and that Labour once again are minority activity, and that Europe's slipping away, and the right are everywhere, everywhere on the march. So yes, I guess we have to ask again, what if?
Bravo. You get the part.
So, I mean, I know, Steve, that was something you were particularly keen to look at. Sorry, Steve F. That was something particularly yes. keen to speak about.
It's a very open kind of ending, yeah. isn't it, I guess? I guess it's meant to make the audience think. But are you kind of nudging them in a certain direction to think in certain ways at that point in March 2017? Or are you? Is it just, well, you know, let's just think how things might have been? Is it as
simple as that? I think it's definitely the former. I mean, interestingly enough, but in terms of the theatricality of that moment, we decided in the end to allow the actor who's playing, the actress who's playing Debbie Owen, Natalie Armin, to actually step out of role, speak in her own voice. We brought up the house lights. You know, it was a real sort of plug into them to the absolute moment of the performance night after night. In fact, she used to well up with tears during that speech. And I mean, a lot of critics hated that, actually. They sort of thought that was crude. But I feel like the times require us not to just sort of sink back into reverie and nostalgia. And clearly, if I thought that I was writing Limehouse as a sort of relaxing account of the, you know, how good the past was, I would have not written a single word. It came out of a genuine feeling of I'm feeling politically homeless, and I feel it even more now when life could not be throwing more grave challenges at us. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, I particularly am preoccupied with, as many, with the profound environmental problems that we face, which I just see nowhere reflected in mainstream politics, including the Labour Party under Corbyn. There's a lot of sort of nods towards Green Deals and so forth, but there's this fundamental feeling they just don't get it. And, you know, so that is a creed de coeur at the end of the play. And I mean, of course, you know, you're seeing this play playing in a sort of rather boutique theatre in London, as you say, Emma, selling out almost sort of 5 minutes after the show's announced. I'm very mindful of the fact that the play gets trapped in that kind of world of relative privilege. So I felt that, I didn't want to make it an entirely comfortable evening, although I think one could have ended an even more abrupt and violent way than I did there. We know from hindsight that what happened on that day in Limehouse was doomed to failure. And I think the reason it was doomed to failure was partly about the people involved. I think it was kind of, I think it'd be the counterfactual of Shirley Williams leading the party. Who knows how that would have played out, but it is interesting how David Owen actually felt very passionately she should have done that, and that she would have offered a very interesting focal point, whereas Roy Jenkins was not the right person to lead a new political party at that time. And sort of, you know, in a way, the very middle classness you were talking about, Emma, if you like, foredoomed the SDP to failure, even though actually their base was quite broad in its kind of social, it was socially diverse to some extent. So, you know, why did that not succeed? And clearly it's a bunch of contingent factors. It is also primarily our electoral system. And that is something which, I mean, I think particularly after 2015 election, when I think there was just a dim sense in the run-up to 2015 election of a new kind of pluralism in British politics. And I really welcomed that, and I really hoped that that would pay off, and it didn't, sadly. So I guess the play again is coming out of that frustration.
That's right. I mean, I want to broaden this out slightly now from this, the focus on this play, political playwriting more generally. I mean, you talked there about what you did and didn't want to do with the play. What is it that has driven you to want to write plays about politics? And what do you think, what is the role of political playwriting?
It's a good and very large question. I mean, I think that there's a degree to which theatre is by default a public art form. So there's a degree to which theatre, whether it wishes it or not, can be understood primarily as a political act, you know, that it even looks like a kind of political act, in a sense that there's a public assembly, there's a gathering of people, there's the sort of intensity of focus that they bring to bear on the show. You know, why would you not want to kind of use that as an opportunity to sort of allow whatever's at the front of all our minds to somehow play out on stage? On the other hand, it's an art form, it's a form of entertainment. And I think there's a certain type of sort of, you know, the problem of worthiness, which obviously attends upon all art, where there's, you know, a desire to change the audience or make them think about something you want them to think about, is something that we have to be really mindful of. And I would happily accept the sort of designation that I'm a political playwright, but I think that people who come to my plays for politics, in the sense of, you know, here's what to do next, will be generally disappointed. I try and write about the things that I care about and that worry me and that perplex me. I don't always know where I'm going to go with it when I enter into it. I just know if the characters are interesting, the situation preoccupies me. I think Limehouse is one of the few times I've actually written about politicians as well. I'm generally, I suppose, of the mind that whatever political theatre is, you might also describe it as kind of ethical theatre. And that goes right back to Greek tragedy, doesn't it? I mean, it seems to me the very first types of theatrical activity could be described as political theatre because, you know, societies stage their preoccupations and their concerns. They put in front of themselves on a stage or on a screen the things that, if you like, are shared problems. And it doesn't mean they're going to resolve them within the 2 hours traffic of a stage, but they might reach some level of clarity, some level of, if you like, a kind of, I mean, I'm not going to use the word catharsis, but working something through or working something out. And I think that should be also happening in the writer's process too. The worst type of political theatre is just merely somebody with a theorem that they kind of place in front of the audience as if they, you know, might as well just read the programme note, frankly. So other things like the vividness of the characters and humour. I mean, Limehouse is largely a comedy, I would say, until it's kind of sort of two-thirds through. It is a comedy about a group of people trying to make something very unlikely happen in very short order. And most of my plays have a very strong comic dimension to them. But I always think you start with humour and you end in something more sort of thought-provoking, hopefully. And that's the sort of trajectory of the plays I like to write.
Oh, there's definitely humour in Limehouse, and there's possibly even more humour in Temple, actually. And actually, because that's the only other play, which I didn't see that either, but I have read it, where it just brings out that I think you can tell me if I'm wrong, but you try to bring out, I mean, politics is about ideas, but it's also about people, and it's not about simple, straightforward, we must do this, but it's about people agonising over things. They feel they have to do something even though they don't really want to do it, but you know, even if it might not be the right thing, this is something they really have to do. And it's too banal just to say politics, you're just demonstrating how complex politics is, but it's actually quite necessary sometimes to row people back and say, you know, you're always banging on about politicians and they're not doing this, they're not doing that, you know, this is not an easy job. This is not something that's you can just knock off. These are about big issues, and you don't know. And this is literally kind of, I guess, the whole point about Limehouse. These are people who are discussing doing something that we all know doesn't work. Yeah. But they're trying to work out, well, will it? I mean, what effects will it have? And then just in the end, jumping and making that choice. So I mean, if it's only just to bring people to the point that, you know, hang on a minute, politics is not something that you can just rattle off, and real people are involved, and it's a very uncertain kind of thing. I think that's a very useful. I don't know if that's what your intention has been, but that's certainly what I was getting from those two plays.
Yeah, it's definitely part of it. I mean, I think that, I find it very difficult to make decisions. I don't know about you guys. I mean, anything. I find it very difficult to make decisions. And I actually think, you know, I mean, writers and academics to some extent, but perhaps less so, writers are often, you know, at one remove from decision making in life, actually. Maybe that's one's constructed one's existence to avoid making decisions. And, you know, I mean, the dean in Temple is a classic example of somebody who finds themselves right in the middle of a kind of public kind of firestorm around trying to deal with the Occupy events outside his temple. And, you know, by what means can he make the right decision? I think, he makes the wrong decision, which is kind of where the play is moving. And I'm always quite interested in people who in a way do things I don't agree with at first glance. I think they're the people that are quite useful to think about in front of an audience. And we can all get behind people that we basically agree with. But, you know, what do we do with people that we really profoundly don't agree with? So that's the sort of thing that excites me in a play, where there is that sort of challenge to the audience and challenge to the characters, which comes out of almost impossible situations. And that, again, that returns to tragedy, I suppose. That tragedy is always about, you know, it's like Hegel said of Antigone, it's about two equally justified ethical positions. And, you know, you're kind of looking for those moments of the so-called wicked problems in a play. And something that's worth looking at for 2 hours as well. I mean, after all, we're all busy people. We don't just want to tell stories that actually you could get a glance from the internet. So wherever there's something that can sit quite heavily on the shoulders of the characters, and that we can understand in depth, that's when my imagination gets going, I suppose.
Is there any likelihood that Limehouse might be restaged, given?
Yeah, I hope so. There's a flurry of interest, and various, you know, people, I mean, I know various directors who'd quite like to do it. And of course, at the point of the independent defections, there was, you know, you get this kind of sudden sort of, well, Limehouse should be on now. And, you know, there was going to be a reading. And I mean, I don't get my hopes up too much. I think if a play is good, it will go on again. It'll find its moment and its time. I mean, there's always a problematic zone between a first production and a subsequent production, if you see what I mean, that the actual investment up front in a show is so huge that unless it instantly goes into a sort of transfer, that becomes quite laborious. But I think the odds are pretty good. And I think the current political situation is making the odds better and better every day.
Yes. I mean, there's certainly a lot that's happening. I mean, the temptation is just to keep writing plays because so much keeps happening. I do a lot of theatre reviewing. I review at least one piece of theatre a week at the moment, which is exhausting, frankly. but there's and not just political stuff, thank God. But I mean, it's so fascinating. And I think, you know, my sort of baseline for a play is that I want to laugh for the first three quarters and then cry at the end. That's, you know, that's how the play works. But ultimately, I think that it is about people. So I've seen some very good political theatre. Although I never saw Limehouse staged, I've really enjoyed reading it. And while I might have a different view of some of the characters than the play necessarily presents me with, I don't like Shirley Williams, never have. There's a line where someone says that she's better than Jenny Lee, and I'm like, yeah, she bloody hell. but that's my own socialism rising to the fore. I don't have to like a character to think that they're well depicted, well rounded, interestingly dramatised. As you say, political theatre is just trying to hammer home a point too hard, and that can be across genres. So I saw, some examples of some particularly bad things I've seen recently. There was a Corbyn the musical, which was just dire. And I couldn't even work out like who it was supposed to please. It was just, I mean, it was, it, all the jokes were so sixth form. Oh, look, Corbyn had an affair with Diane Abbott. Isn't that funny? Like, no, not really. It's just me. And then there was another play, which the name is escaping me, but it was about the setting up of a new party. And very similar to themes explored in Limehouse, except it was such an, because it was fictionalized, it was done in such an unrealistic way. And that for me, and I think, you know, that's the, there was no heart to it. There was no understanding of any of the motivations because it was just forcing an agenda.
Yeah, well, it's many things contribute to making a show work, it seems to me. But I haven't seen either of the shows you mentioned, and Corbin the Musical, just the title already tells me I will never see it. But you know, both parts of that statement are not promising to me. But I think, you know, there's obviously a role for topical, fun engagements with you know, contemporary politics, and you know, there'll be hundreds of shows about Brexit and so forth. But I think a play needs to sort of have a longer view. And I mean, August Wilson, the great American, Afro-American playwright, talks about, you know, you evaluate the play by the size of the question it asks. And I actually think that is what divides theatre from a half an hour TV programme or, you know, or a not particularly good play, is how large is that question and how is that embodied in characters that actually provide great acting parts. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work with Simon Russell Beale or Roger Allam. I don't mean because I'm fantastic, but I mean those parts were big enough for them to feel that they wanted to get their teeth into them. Mm. And, you know, one of the reasons I love working in theatre is to be close in the room with actors who have great facility and offer that complexity you were talking about, Steve. I think it is in, you know, the actors as much as anything. But it's a hit and miss endeavour. I actually think at the moment, you look in vain for much that kind of I would call political theatre in London, certainly, of any substance. And I don't mean that to discredit the work that's on, but I just think we're in a sort of period of a slight anxiety about that kind of work. There's a lot of American plays, for instance. I mean, many of them extremely good, but one looks in vain for kind of good new contemporary plays that speak to the situation we find ourselves in, and not just in London, of course, as you say, Steve. I mean, you know, I'm interested, I mean, luckily I'm working in Sheffield next, so I'm out of the Westminster bubble. But I think it really is important to use all the, you know, kind of lands theatres to try and ask these kind of questions, and often you hear them more clearly asked in theatres in cities such as Sheffield or Nottingham or elsewhere. But it, you know, it's high risk stuff, it's expensive, and audiences aren't always in the mood for it, frankly. So nobody could say that political theatre will sell you tickets by default. It might well have the opposite effect.
So if you were, I mean, you've touched on a few contemporary themes there, but if you wanted to write the thing that's not being written now, what tempts you?
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I've shot my bolt with environmental questions. And one of my sort of plays I'm most proud of was a piece called The Contingency Plan I wrote 10 years ago now, which was sort of about climate change. And I mean, I am very preoccupied with how we turn that into a viable politics, both in my life and in my writing. And I look for work of that nature and I try and contribute where I can. I mean, funny enough, Brexit, of course, you know, is the elephant in the room, which is unfortunately all too in the room. And I don't know how one writes fruitfully about that. Actually, it is because it's such a sort of changing situation anyway, there's a degree to which trying to kind of think more deeply about Brexit has become very, very difficult, I think. But I mean, I've been writing a play about trade unions, interestingly enough, which has been inflected a little bit by that division between, you know, kind of England with and without London. I mean, I'm from Coventry originally, and I just got quite interested in a story which kind of looks at, you know, what happens if suddenly the care sector walks, you know, or kind of outsourcing fails. I mean, which obviously is happening almost on a daily basis. And what would a story of that nature look like? And I feel like kind of those trade unions, the absence of trade unions from the centre of British life, although of course they actually have a little more influence than the Labour Party than they once did, but to see them, if you remember the 70s and 80s, there was barely a day went by when we didn't hear a major union figure being consulted on one question or another. has created this great vacuum for the representation of working class people in British life. So that's been a very exciting project to sort of explore, but we're not there yet. It's not going to be on imminently, but that's certainly a space I wanted to fill with my own writing.
All right. So you're not really tempted by the tragedy of Teresa or
I find her so dull. I mean, you know, dull, exasperating, you know.
But is she that dull? Beneath the surface, though, do you think there's no surface to explore? No?
Well, I've not seen any evidence of it as yet.
Maybe Gordon Brown. I mean, Gordon Brown always, I think a lot of people made the, you know, the kind of, had the thought that Gordon Brown was this tragic figure. Mm. But I think he was very complicated. Yes. I mean, but more complicated than he could understand himself, I think.
No, probably. I think that's right. But it's interesting you thought about him so quickly after Theresa May, because there is a sort of shared lack of suppleness in both of them. I mean, I think he had a far more depth and hinterland. I mean, Theresa May just seems to lack the fundamental ingredient of a politician, which is intellectual suppleness, completely not there. And
I guess it made the play it'd be about people talking about her. She'd never be in the room, but they'd always be coming out of a room.
Yes.
I think play would be about Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, actually. That's what needs to be written.
Well, 18 months ago, that their project with her looked moderately interesting, didn't it? There was something about that attempt to sort of offer a kind of blue Tory. No, there is blue Tory. Red Toryism, I suppose, is what I'm trying to talk about. Blue Toryism is a tautology.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, for joining us. I look forward to seeing, hopefully, your union play. It sounds interesting. And as someone who did a year at the TUC, I'm sure I'll recognise lots of the themes.
I may be calling on you, Emma.
Please do. Other Steve, thank you very much, as always. And please do, everybody, check out Steve's documentary on Radio 4. It is absolutely fascinating. And we will put a link in the show notes. It just leaves me to say... thank you to our listeners, as always. And please do, if you have enjoyed this, please do rate and review us on iTunes. And this has been a Political Human production.